Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Chapter 17. From Cape Horn to the Amazon. How I got onto the platform, I have no idea. Perhaps the Canadian had carried me there. But I breathed. I inhaled the vivifying sea air. My two companions were getting drunk with the fresh particles. We had no end to restrain ourselves. We could draw this air freely into our lungs, and it was the breeze alone, that filled us with this keen enjoyment. "Ah," said Conseil, "how delightful this oxygen is. Master need not fear to breathe it. There is enough for everybody." Ned Land did not speak, but he opened his jaws wide enough to frighten a shark. Our strength soon returned, and when I looked round me, I saw we were alone on the platform. The foreign seamen in the Nautilus were contented with the air that circulated in the interior. None of them had come to drink in the open air. The first words I spoke were words of gratitude and thankfulness to my two companions. Ned and Conseil had prolonged my life during the last hours of this long agony. All my gratitude could not repay such devotion. "My friends," said I, "we are bound one to the other forever, and I am under infinite obligations to you." "Which I shall take advantage of," exclaimed the Canadian. "What do you mean?" said Conseil. "I mean that I shall take you with me when I leave this infernal Nautilus." "Well," said Conseil, "after all this, are we going, right?" "Yes," I replied, "for we are going the way of the sun, and here the sun is in the north." "No doubt," said Ned Land, "but it remains to be seen whether he will bring the ship into the Pacific or the Atlantic Ocean, that is, into frequented or deserted seas." I could not answer that question, and I feared that Captain Nemo would rather take us to the vast ocean that touches the coasts of Asia and America at the same time. He would thus complete the tour round the submarine world and return to those waters in which the Nautilus could sail freely. We ought, before long, to settle this important point. The Nautilus went at a rapid pace. The polar circle was soon passed, and the course shaped for Cape Horn. We were off the American point, March 31st, at 7 o'clock in the evening. Then all our past sufferings were forgotten. The remembrance of that imprisonment in the ice was effaced from our minds. We only thought of the future. Captain Nemo did not appear again, either in the drawing room or on the platform. The point shown each day on the planisphere, and marked by the lieutenant, showed me the exact direction of the Nautilus. Now, on that evening, it was evident, to my great satisfaction, that we were going back to the north by the Atlantic. The next day, April 1st, when the Nautilus ascended to the surface some minutes before noon, we sighted land to the west. It was Terra del Fuego, which the first navigators named thus from seeing the quantity of smoke that rose from the natives' huts. The coast seemed low to me, but in the distance rose high mountains. I even thought I had a glimpse of Mount Sarmiento, that rises 2,070 yards above the level of the sea, with a very pointed summit, which, according as it is misty or clear, is a sign of finer wet weather. At this moment, the peak was clearly defined against the sky. The Nautilus, diving again under the water, approached the coast, which was only some few miles off. From the glass windows in the drawing room, I saw long seaweeds and gigantic fuci, of which the open polar sea contains so many specimens, with their sharp, polished filaments. They measured about 300 yards in length, real cables, thicker than one's thumb, and having great tenacity, they are often used as ropes for vessels. Another weed, known as velp, with leaves 4 feet long, buried in the coral concretions, hung at the bottom. It served as nest and food for myriads of mollusks, crabs, and cuttlefish. There, seals and otters had splendid repasts, eating the flesh of fish with sea vegetables, according to the English fashion. Over this fertile and luxuriant ground, the Nautilus passed with great rapidity. Towards evening, it approached the Falkland group, the rough summits of which I recognized the following day. The depth of the sea was moderate. On the shores, our nets brought in beautiful specimens of seaweed, and particularly a certain fucus, the roots of which were filled with the best mussels in the world. Geese and ducks fell by dozens on the platform and soon took their places in the pantry on board. When the last heights of the Falklands had disappeared from the horizon, the Nautilus sank to between 20 and 25 yards and followed the American coast. Captain Nemo did not show himself. Until the 3rd of April, we did not quit the shores of Patagonia, sometimes under the ocean, sometimes at the surface. The Nautilus passed beyond the large estuary formed by the Uruguay. Its direction was northwards, and followed the long windings of the coast of South America. We had then made 1,600 miles since our embarkation in the seas of Japan. About 11 o'clock in the morning, the Tropic of Capricorn was crossed on the 37th meridian, and we passed Cape Frio, standing out to sea. Captain Nemo, to Ned Land's great displeasure, did not like the neighborhood of the inhabited coast of Brazil, for we went at a giddy speed. Not a fish, not a bird of the swiftest kind could follow us, and the natural curiosities of these seas escaped all observation. This speed was kept up for several days, and in the evening on the 9th of April, we sighted the most westerly point of South America that forms Cape San Roque. But then the Nautilus swerved again and sought the lowest depth of a submarine valley, which is between this cape and Sierra Leone on the African coast. This valley bifurcates to the parallel of the Antilles and terminates at the mouth by the enormous depression of 9,000 yards. In this place, the geological basin of the ocean forms, as far as the Lesser Antilles, a cliff to 3.5 miles perpendicular in height, and, at the parallel of the Cape Verde Islands, an other wall not less considerable that encloses thus all the sunk continent of the Atlantic. The bottom of this immense valley is dotted with some mountains that give to these submarine places a picturesque aspect. I speak, moreover, from the manuscript charts that were in the library of the Nautilus, charts evidently due to Captain Nemo's hand and made after his personal observations. For 2 days, the desert and deep waters were visited by means of the inclined planes. The Nautilus was furnished with long diagonal broadsides, which carried it to all elevations. But on the 11th of April, it rose suddenly, and land appeared at the mouth of the Amazon River, a vast estuary, the embouchure of which is so considerable that it freshens the seawater for the distance of several leagues. The equator was crossed. 20 miles to the west were the Guianas of French territory, on which we could have found an easy refuge. But a stiff breeze was blowing, and the furious waves would not have allowed a single boat to face them. Ned Land understood that, no doubt, for he spoke not a word about it. For my part, I made no allusion to his schemes of flight, for I would not urge him to make an attempt that must inevitably fail. I made the time pass pleasantly by interesting studies. During the days of April 11th and 12th, the Nautilus did not leave the surface of the sea, and the net brought in a marvelous haul of zoophytes, fish, and reptiles. Some zoophytes had been fished up by the chain of the nets. I had now an opportunity of studying several species of fish on these shores. A sort of eel, 15 inches long, with a greenish head, violet fins, gray-blue back, brown belly, silvered and sewn with bright spots, the pupil of the eye encircled with gold. A curious animal, that the current of the Amazon had drawn to the sea, for they inhabit fresh waters. Tuberculated streaks, with pointed snouts and a long loose tail, armed with a long jagged sting. Little sharks, a yard long, gray and whitish skin, and several rows of teeth, bent back, that are generally known by the name pantoufles. Vespertilios, a kind of red isosceles triangle, half a yard long, to which pectorals are attached by fleshy prolongations that make them look like bats, but that their horny appendage, situated near the nostrils, has given them the name of sea unicorns. I end here this catalogue, which is somewhat dry, perhaps, but very exact, with a series of bony fish that I observed in passing belonging to the apteranotes, and whose snout is white as snow, the body of a beautiful black, marked with a very long, loose, fleshy strip. Sardines, 9 inches long, glittering with a bright silver light. A species of mackerel provided with two anal fins. Centronotes of a blackish tint that are fished for with torches. Longfish, 2 yards in length, with fat flesh, white and firm, which, when they arc fresh, taste like eel, and when dry, like smoked salmon. Labrus, half-red, covered with scales, only at the bottom of the dorsal and anal fins. Golden-tailed spares, the flesh of which is extremely delicate, and whose phosphorescent properties betray them in the midst of the waters. Orange-colored spares, with long tongues. Notwithstanding this etc., I must not omit to mention fish that Conseil will long remember, and with good reason. One of our nets had hauled up a sort of very flat rayfish, which, with the tail cut off, formed a perfect disc, and weighed 20 ounces. It was white underneath, red above, with large round spots of dark blue encircled with black, very glossy skin, terminating in a bilobed fin. Laid out on the platform, it struggled, tried to turn itself by convulsive movements, and made so many efforts that one last turn had nearly sent it into the sea. But Conseil, not wishing to let the fish go, rushed to it, and before I could prevent him, had seized it with both hands. In a moment he was overthrown, his legs in the air, and half his body paralyzed, crying, "Oh, master, master, help me!" It was the first time the poor boy had spoken to me so familiarly. The Canadian and I took him up and rubbed his contracted arms till he became sensible. The unfortunate Conseil had attacked a cramp fish of the most dangerous kind, the cumana. This odd animal, in a medium conductor like water, strikes fish at several yards' distance, so great is the power of its electric organ, the two principal surfaces of which do not measure less than 27 square feet. The next day, April 12th, the Nautilus approached the Dutch coast, near the mouth of the Moroni. There, several groups of sea cows herded together. They were manatees. These beautiful animals, peaceable and inoffensive, from 18 to 21 feet in length, weigh at least 16 hundredweight. I told Ned Land and Conseil that nature had assigned an important role to these mammalia. Indeed, they, like the seals, are destined to graze on the submarine prairies, and thus destroy the accumulation of weed that obstructs the tropical rivers. "And do you know," I added, "what has been the result since men have almost entirely annihilated this useful race? That the putrefied weeds have poisoned the air, and the poison air causes the yellow fever that desolates these beautiful countries. Enormous vegetations are multiplied under the torrid seas, and the evil is irresistibly developed from the mouth of the Rio de la Plata to Florida. If we are to believe Toussenel, this plague is nothing to what it would be if the seas were cleaned of whales and seals. Then, infested with polyps, medusae, and cuttlefish, they would become immense centers of infection, since their waves would not possess these vast stomachs that God had charged to infest the surface of the seas." Chapter 18. Polyps. For several days the Nautilus kept off from the American coast. Evidently, it did not wish to risk the tides of the Gulf of Mexico or of the Sea of the Antilles. April 16th, we sighted Martinique and Guadeloupe from a distance of about 30 miles. I saw their tall peaks for an instant. The Canadian, who counted on carrying out his projects in the Gulf by either landing or hailing one of the numerous boats that coast from one island to another, was quite disheartened. Flight would have been quite practicable if Ned Land had been able to take possession of the boat without the captain's knowledge. But in the open sea, it could not be thought of. The Canadian, Conseil, and I had a long conversation on this subject. For 6 months, we had been prisoners on board the Nautilus. We had traveled 17,000 leagues, and, as Ned Land said, there was no reason why it should come to an end. We could hope nothing from the captain of the Nautilus, but only from ourselves. Besides, for some time past, he had become graver, more retired, less sociable. He seemed to shun me. I met him rarely. Formerly, he was pleased to explain the submarine marvels to me. Now he left me to my studies, and came no more to the saloon. What change had come over him? For what cause? For my part, I did not wish to bury with me my curious and novel studies. I had now the power to write the true book of the sea, and this book, sooner or later, I wished to see daylight. The land nearest us was the archipelago of the Bahamas. There rose high submarine cliffs, covered with large weeds. It was about 11 o'clock when Ned Land drew my attention to a formidable pricking, like the sting of an ant, which was produced by means of large seaweeds. "Well," I said, "these are proper caverns for polyps, and I should not be astonished to see some of these monsters." "What?" said Conseil. "Cuttlefish." "No," I said, "polyps of huge dimensions." "I will never believe that such animals exist," said Ned. "Well," said Conseil, with the most serious air in the world, "I remember perfectly to have seen a large vessel drawn under the waves by an octopus's arm." "You saw that," said the Canadian. "Yes, Ned." "With your own eyes?" "With my own eyes." "Where, pray, might that be?" "At St. Malo," answered Conseil. "In the port," said Ned ironically. "No, in a church," replied Conseil. "In a church," cried the Canadian. "Yes, friend Ned, in a picture representing the pulp in question." "Good," said Ned Land, bursting out laughing. "He is quite right," I said. "I have heard of this picture, but the subject represented is taken from a legend, and you know what to think of legends in the matter of natural history. Besides, when it is a question of monsters, the imagination is apt to run wild. Not only is it supposed that these polyps can draw down vessels, but a certain Olaus Magnus speaks of an octopus a mile long that is more like an island than an animal. It is also said that the Bishop of Nidros was building an altar on an immense rock. Mass finished, the rock began to walk and returned to the sea. The rock was a polyp. Another bishop speaks also of a polyp on which a regiment of cavalry could maneuver. Lastly, the ancient naturalists speak of monsters whose mouths were like gulfs, and which were too large to pass through the Straits of Gibraltar. "But how much is true of these stories?" asked Conseil. "Nothing, my friends, at least of that which passes the limit of truth to get to fable or legend. Nevertheless, there must be some ground for the imagination of the storytellers. One cannot deny that polyps and cuttlefish exist of a large species, inferior, however, to the cetaceans. Aristotle has stated the dimensions of a cuttlefish as 5 cubits, or 9 feet 2 inches. Our fishermen frequently see some that are more than 4 feet long. Some skeletons of polyps are preserved in museums of Montpellier that measure 2 yards in length. Besides, according to the calculations of some naturalists, one of these animals only 6 feet long would have tentacles 27 feet long. That would suffice to make a formidable monster." "Do they fish for them in these days?" asked Ned. "If they do not fish for them, sailors see them at least. One of my friends has often affirmed that he met one of these monsters of colossal dimensions in the Indian seas. But the most astonishing fact, and which does not permit of the denial of the existence of these gigantic animals, happened some years ago, in 1861. "What is the fact?" asked Ned Land. "This is it. In 1861, to the northeast of Tenerife, very nearly in the same latitude we are in now, the crew of the dispatch boat Elector perceived a monstrous cuttlefish swimming in the waters. The captain went near to the animal and attacked it with harpoons and guns, without much success, for balls and harpoons glided over the soft flesh. After several fruitless attempts, the crew tried to pass a slipknot round the body of the mollusk. The noose slipped as far as the tail fins, and there stopped. They tried then to haul it on board, but its weight was so considerable that the tightness of the cord separated the tail from the body, and deprived of this ornament, he disappeared under the water." "Indeed, is that a fact?" "An indisputable fact, my good Ned." "What length was it?" asked the Canadian. "Did it not measure about 6 yards?" said Conseil, who, posted at the window, was examining again the irregular windings of the cliff. "Precisely," I replied. "Its head," rejoined Conseil, "was it not crowned with 8 tentacles that beat the water like a nest of serpents?" "Precisely." "Had not its eyes, placed at the back of its head, considerable development?" "Yes, Conseil." "And was not its mouth like a parrot's beak?" "Exactly, Conseil." "Very well. No offense to master," he replied quietly. "If this is not that cuttlefish, it is at least one of its brothers." I looked at Conseil. Ned Land hurried to the window. "What a horrible beast!" he cried. I looked in my turn, and could not repress a gesture of disgust. Before my eyes was a horrible monster, worthy to figure in the legends of the marvelous. It was an immense cuttlefish, being 8 yards long. It swam crossways in the direction of the Nautilus with great speed, watching us with its enormous staring green eyes. Its 8 arms, or rather feet, fixed to its head, were twice as long as its body, and were twisted like the fury's hair. One could see the 250 air holes on the inner side of the tentacles. The monster's mouth, a horned beak like a parrot's, opened and shut vertically. Its tongue, a horned substance, furnished with several rows of pointed teeth, came out quivering from this veritable pair of shears. What a freak of nature! A bird's beak on a mollusk! Its spindle-like body formed a fleshy mass that might weigh 4,000 to 5,000 pounds. The varying color, changing with great rapidity, according to the irritation of the animal, passed successively from livid gray to reddish-brown. What irritated this mollusk? No doubt the presence of the Nautilus, more formidable than itself, and on which its suckers or its jaws had no hold. Yet what monsters these polyps are! What vitality the Creator has given them! What vigor in their movements! And they possess 3 hearts! Chance had brought us in presence of this cuttlefish, and I did not wish to lose the opportunity of carefully studying this specimen. I overcame the horror that inspired me, and taking a pencil, began to draw it. "Perhaps this is the same which the Elector saw," said Conseil. "No," replied the Canadian, "for this is whole, and the other had lost its tail." "That is no reason," I replied. "The arms and tails of these animals are reformed by renewal, and in 7 years the tail of that cuttlefish has no doubt had time to grow." By this time, other polyps appeared at the port light. I counted 7. They formed a procession after the Nautilus, and I heard their beaks gnashing against the iron hull. I continued my work. These monsters kept in the water with such precision that they seemed immovable. Suddenly the Nautilus stopped. A shock made it tremble in every plate. "Have we struck anything?" I asked. "In any case," replied the Canadian, "we shall be free, for we are floating." The Nautilus was floating, no doubt, but it did not move. A minute passed. Captain Nemo, followed by his lieutenant, entered the drawing room. I had not seen him for some time. he seemed dull. Without noticing or speaking to us, he went to the panel, looked at the polyps, and said something to his lieutenant. The latter went out. Soon the panels were shut. The ceiling was lighted. I went towards the captain. "A curious collection of polyps," I said. "Yes, indeed, Mr. Naturalist," he replied. "And we are going to fight them, man to beast." I looked at him. I thought I had not heard right. "Man to beast," I repeated. "Yes, sir, the screw is stopped. I think that the horny jaws of one of the cuttlefish is entangled in the blades. That is what prevents our moving." "What are you going to do?" "Rise to the surface and slaughter this vermin." "A difficult enterprise." "Yes, indeed. The electric bullets are powerless against the soft flesh, where they do not find resistance enough to go off. But we shall attack them with the hatchet." "And the harpoon, sir," said the Canadian, "if you do not refuse my help." "I will accept it, Master Land." "We will follow you," I said. And following Captain Nemo, we went towards the central staircase. There, about 10 men with boarding hatchets were ready for the attack. Conseil and I took 2 hatchets. Ned Land seized a harpoon. The Nautilus had then risen to the surface. One of the sailors, posted on the top ladder step, unscrewed the bolts of the panels. But hardly were the screws loosed when the panel rose with great violence, evidently drawn by the suckers of a polyp's arm. Immediately, one of these arms slid like a serpent down the opening, and 20 others were above. With one blow of the axe, Captain Nemo cut this formidable tentacle that slid wriggling down the ladder. Just as we were pressing one on the other to reach the platform, 2 other arms, lashing the air, came down on the seaman placed before Captain Nemo and lifted him up with irresistible power. Captain Nemo uttered a cry and rushed out. We hurried after him. What a scene! The unhappy man, seized by the tentacle and fixed to the suckers, was balanced in the air at the caprice of this enormous trunk. He rattled in his throat. He was stifled. He cried, "Help! Help!" These words, spoken in French, startled me. I had a fellow countryman on board, perhaps several. That heart-rending cry, I shall hear it all my life. The unfortunate man was lost. Who could rescue him from that powerful pressure? However, Captain Nemo had rushed to the polyp, and with one blow of the axe had cut through one arm. His lieutenant struggled furiously against other monsters that crept on the flanks of the Nautilus. The crew fought with their axes. The Canadian, Conseil, and I buried our weapons in the fleshy masses. A strong smell of musk penetrated the atmosphere. It was horrible. For one instant, I thought that the unhappy man, entangled with the polyp, would be torn from its powerful suction. 7 of the 8 arms had been cut off. 1 only wriggled in the air, brandishing the victim like a feather. But just as Captain Nemo and his lieutenant threw themselves on it, the animal ejected a stream of black liquid. We were blinded with it. When the cloud dispersed, the cuttlefish had disappeared, and my unfortunate countrymen with it. 10 or 12 polyps now invaded the platform and sides of the Nautilus. We rolled pell-mell into the midst of this nest of serpents that wriggled on the platform in the waves of blood and ink. It seemed as though these slimy tentacles sprang up like the hydra's heads. Ned Land's harpoon, at each stroke, was plunged into the staring eyes of the cuttlefish. But my bold companion was suddenly overturned by the tentacles of a monster he had not been able to avoid. Ah, how my heart beat with emotion and horror! The formidable beak of a cuttlefish was open over Ned Land. The unhappy man would be cut in 2. I rushed to him. But Captain Nemo was before me. His axe disappeared between the 2 enormous jaws and miraculously saved the Canadian. Rising, plunged his harpoon deep into the triple heart of the polyp. "I owed myself this revenge," said the captain to the Canadian. Ned bowed without replying. The combat had lasted 1/4 of an hour. The monsters, vanquished and mutilated, left us at last and disappeared under the waves. Captain Nemo, covered with blood, nearly exhausted, gazed upon the sea that had swallowed up one of his companions, and great tears gathered in his eyes.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W., and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Phoebe Reads a Mystery is recorded in the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.